take me far away. So keep them coming, please let me escape. Take me somewhere I've never been.
Hello, welcome to the second season of the Literature Out Loud series produced by the International Center for Writing and Translation with the support of Illuminations at the University of California, Irvine. I'm Carrie Noland, Director of the International Center for Writing and Translation. Literature Out Loud was directed by Sarah Rodriguez, sound engineered by JJ Margolis, with music by Frankie Beach. On this episode, you will hear the messenger scene from The Bacchae by Euripides, translated by William Arrowsmith and read by Ella Turenne. The reading will be followed by an afterword about the play by Professor Zina Giannopoulou. Enjoy.
There were three of us in all, Pentheus and I, attending my master, and that stranger who volunteered to guide us to the show, leaving behind us the last outlying farms of Thebes. We forded an ossipus and struck into the barren scrubland of Cithaeron. There, in the grassy glen, we halted, unmoving, silent, without a word, so we might see but not be seen. From that vantage, in a steep meadow along the sheer rock of the cliffs, a place where water ran and the pines grew dense with shade, we saw the Maenads sitting with their hands busily moving at their happy tasks. Some wound the stalks of their tattered wands with tendrils of fresh ivy. Others, frisking like fillies newly freed from the painted bridles, chanted in Bacchic songs, responsively. But Pentheus, unhappy man, could not quite see the companies of women. "Stranger," he said, "from where we stand, I cannot see these counterfeited Maenads. But if I climb that towering fir that overhangs the banks, then I could see their shameless orgies better." And now the stranger worked a miracle. Reaching for the highest branch of the great fir, he bent it down, down, down to the dark earth, till it was curved the way a taut bough bends, or like a rim of wood when forced about the circle of a wheel. Like that he forced the mountain fir down to the ground. No mortal could have done it. Then he seated Pentheus at the highest tip, and with his hands let the trunk rise straightly up, slowly and gently, lest it throw its rider. And the tree rose, towering to the heaven, with my master seated at the top. And now the Maenads saw him more clearly than he saw them, but barely had they seen when the stranger vanished. And there came a great voice out of heaven, Dionysus, it must have been, crying, "Women, I bring you the man who mocks at you and me and at our holy mysteries. Take vengeance upon him." And as he spoke, a flash of awful fire bound earth and heaven. The high air hushed, and along the forest glen the leaves hung still. You could hear no cry of beasts. The Bacchae heard that voice, but missed its words, and leaping up, they stared, peering everywhere. Again, that voice, and now they knew his cry, the clear command of Bacchus. Breaking loose like startled doves, through grove and torrent, over rocks, the Bacchae flew, their feet maddened by God's breath. And when they saw my master perching on his tree, they climbed a great rock that towered opposite his perch and showered him with stones and branches of fir, while the others hurled their wands. What grim target practice! But they didn't hit Pentheus. Barely out of reach of their eager hands, treed, unable to escape. Finally, They splintered branches from the oaks, and with those bars of wood tried to lever up the tree by prying at its roots. But every effort failed. Then Agave cried out, "Maenads, make a circle about the trunk and grip it with your hands. Unless we take this climbing beast, he will reveal the secrets of the god." With that, thousands of hands tore the fir tree from the earth, and down, down from his high perch fell Pentheus, tumbling to the ground, sobbing and screaming as he fell, for he knew his end was near. His own mother, like a priestess with her victim, fell upon him first, but snatching from his hair the headband so poor Agave would recognize and spare him, he said, touching her cheeks, "No, mother, I am Pentheus, your own son, the child you bore to Echion. Pity me, spare me, mother. I have done a wrong, but do not kill your own son for that offense." But she was foaming at the mouth, and her crazed eyes rolled with frenzy. She was mad, stark mad, possessed by Bacchus. Ignoring his cries of pity, she seized his left arm at the wrist, then, planting her foot upon his chest, she pulled, wrenching away the arm at the shoulder, not by her own strength, for the god had put inhuman power in her hands. I know. Meanwhile, on the other side, was scratching off his flesh. The Atanawe and the whole horde of Bacchae swarmed upon him, shouts everywhere, him groaning with what little breath was left, them shrieking in triumph. One bore off an arm, another a foot still warm in its shoe. His ribs were clawed clean of flesh, and every hand was smeared with blood as they played ball with scraps of Pentheus's body. The pitiful remains lie scattered, one piece among the sharp rocks, others among the leaves in the deep woods, not easy to search for. His mother, picking up his head, impaled it on her wand. She seems to think it is some mountain lion's head, which she carries in triumph through the thick of Cithaeron. Leaving her sisters at the Maenad dances, she is coming here, gloating over her grisly prize. She calls upon Bacchus. He is her fellow huntsman, comrade of the chase, crowned with victory. But all the victory she carries home is her own grief. Now, before Agave returns, I shall leave this scene of sorrow. Humility, a sense of reverence before the sons of heaven. Of all the prizes that a mortal man might win, these, I say, are wisest. These are best.
You tell me stories, they take me far away. So keep them calm and please let me escape. Take me somewhere I've never been. Show me something new, I insist.
Euripides' Bacchae is an exuberant, wild play. Produced in Athens sometime after the author's death, probably in 407 or 406 BCE, it dramatizes the collective punishment of the Thebans for refusing to accept the divinity of Dionysus, god of wine and the theater. Conceived by Zeus and Semele, but sprung from Zeus's thigh, Dionysus returns to Thebes from Asia to prove that he is indeed the son of Zeus. His lineage has been contested in Greece, and he has been denied his rites, rituals, and worship. He is here to set the record straight, followed by Asiatic slave women, his bacae or maenads. These foreigners are soon joined by native Theban women who follow them and the god in an ecstatic trance to the mountain where they perform secret rites. This all takes place while Pentheus, the king of Thebes and Dionysus' maternal cousin, is away. As a man of reason and secular power, Pentheus is desperate to restore law and order in Thebes. Tapping into his desire to watch the women on the mountain, Dionysus convinces him to cross-dress, and after parading him through the streets of Thebes, leads him to the mountain where he is attacked by the Bacchae and finally torn to pieces by his own mother, Agave. Once she has returned to Thebes with her prey, Agave recognizes her own son, and Dionysus appears as Deus Ex Machina to distribute punishments to all. Pentheus' death is the climax of the play, where an immoderate, because immoderately rational man, gets his comeuppance. Other Thebans are also punished, but Pentheus' death is the most spectacularly savage. As the god of irrationality, the free flow of emotions symbolized by liquid wine, Dionysus is inherently problematic to Apollonian Thebes, a menace to its tidy rationality. The messenger, who narrates the scene, conveys this problem by using verbs of motion to refer to Dionysus' followers. They move at their tasks and sing, frisking like fillies, while reserving the verb to see, which connotes to know in ancient Greek, as in English, for the rational Pentheus, who cannot see the Maenads from his initial hiding place, and asks to be put atop a tall fir so that he might see them better. Once placed on the highest branch of the fir, however, the Maenads saw him more clearly than he saw them. Note the use of the gaze as a power tool. So long as Pentheus observes the Maenads unobserved, he is safe, since their activities may be safely witnessed only by those initiated in the Dionysiac religion. Pentheus re-domesticates the women, who have left their homes and families, by looking at them, but dies when looked at by them. Recall what happens in the theater when the actors break the fourth wall. The theatrical illusion shatters, and the spectators are drawn into the action. In a way, they die as mere spectators and become co-performers. When the Maenads return Pentheus' gaze, they look at him looking at them, which threatens his sense of control and security. They also replace his kingly power with the values of cooperation and harmony prevalent in their worship of Dionysus in nature. The cruel side of these values is on display in Pentheus' punishment, when all the Maenads, led by Agave, circle the trunk of the fir tree, uproot it, and tear Pentheus to pieces. The punishment joins together filicide, dismemberment, and sacrifice, and it is brutal. Like a possessed priestess of Dionysus, Agave falls on her prey, mistaking him for a climbing beast. The cross-dressed Pentheus, sobbing and screaming, in the full realization that his end is nigh, removes his wig and snood in a desperate attempt to be recognized. Now he begs to be seen. But he cannot be seen as he wants to be seen, a man of fixed identity and lineage, because he is in the realm of irrationality, where categories are fluid and borders are porous. In two of the most moving lines in Greek tragedy, Pentheus tries to atone for his hubris so as to prevent his mother committing filicide, a crime that will cause her grief and result in exile. Pity me, spare me, mother. I have done a wrong, but do not kill your own son for my offense. His last words are an admission of wrongdoing by a man, I have done a wrong, my offense, who is other than agave sun, do not kill your own son. The split of the subject is exquisitely Dionysiac. The son of an irrational mother, and by extension irrational himself, has come to believe what his rational I did not believe, that Dionysus is God. At long last, Pentheus gets it, but it is too late, and divine violence is catastrophic. In death, he enacts the meaning of his name. He becomes a man of grief, as his precious physical I is disintegrated and scattered to the winds, while the possessed Maenads play ball with scraps of Pentheus's body. This is poetry at its best and most ferocious. Pentheus's death is usually viewed as a staging of Dionysus' terrifying power, his unassuaged vindictiveness, his wild cruelty, and it doubtless is all that. What is less often noticed, however, is the almost tender care with which Euripides shields Agave from the realization that she is killing her own son. He does this by exalting the illusionistic power of Dionysus as god of the theater to merge actor with character. In his death throes, the actor playing Pentheus enacts Pentheus dressed as woman and perceived by Agave as beast. This double refraction allows the god's revenge to be implemented by a mother who behaves most unmotherly because duped by the god's theatrical power. Agave is deluded by the god she worships because delusion is the name of his game. This is Dionysus' brand of kindness, or at least his mercy.
Thank you for listening. For more episodes of Literature Out Loud, please visit humanities.uci.edu/ICWT.
Take me somewhere I've never been. Show me something new, I insist. Take me somewhere I've